Welcome to We Got Balls, real, raw, masculine sex talk with Chris Inman and Scott Cohn. Chris and Scott both work with men who want to leave their unwanted sexual struggles in the past. They are willing to do whatever it takes to help men get curious about what drives their compulsive sexual behavior. With that said, here we go.
Hey guys, welcome back to We Got Balls, and today we have an interesting conversation on the pink cloud, or as Scott likes to call it, white knuckling. What happens, guys? And listen to this episode if you're curious. What happens when you figure out how to stop the behavior, but you don't feel any damn different? You just think, I thought I was supposed to be better than this. I thought if I just stopped whatever it was, my masturbation or my hooking up or my pornography use or whatever it is that you're struggling with, whatever addictive process, compulsive behavior that you deal with, when you finally get the chance to stop it and you have that maybe even a few weeks of feeling good, but then you're like, what the hell's going on? It's not any different. You're living on the pink cloud. You are white knuckling it. So let's talk about that today. So when you hear that, Scott, or...
I was going to say in AA, they call it a dry drunk. And so what's our term? I guess it would be dry jacking because like kind of the core baseline activity for us is masturbating. Isn't it really like that is the Budweiser of sexual addiction, jacking off.
In fact, we were just talking about this. I love watching the Chappelle Show. And one of the sketches in Chappelle Show is called Knee High Park. It's about, it's a, like a PSA with puppets and sexually transmitted diseases. And one of the puppets is singing one of his songs. And then a line in his song is, I beat my dick like it owes me money. And yeah, so when we stop doing that junk, when we're like, oh, I've got some victory over this, and we feel like we've arrived. In fact, I would argue that's the point of the NoFap community, is they argue that just stopping the behavior, just getting to the place where you don't struggle with this particular shameful thing anymore, is what recovery is about. And and you get there and you'll be great. You'll be rescued. You'll be healed.
Can I go on a little rant here for a second about this?
Run wild.
You can pull me back, but now you just pulled the cord and I am going to go hog shit wild on this. I would say it's not just... What were you referring to? The community.
NoFap.
What was the community you were referring to? The NoFaps. NoFaps. Okay. It's not just them. It's 12 step and it's CSATs.
Ooh, you're touching on the angels. You're touching on the Holy Grail here, Scott. Now,
I went there.
Caveat. Real quick, before you keep going, let's just say this caveat. Any work is good work. We're not disparaging anybody who's moving forward in their recovery process and trying to get better and connecting with people. You got to go through what you got to go through, but continue.
So I speak from experience on this, because when I entered recovery, I started with a really well-known recovery expert who shall not be named. But his whole approach was based on getting evangelicals to just stop it, right? And so it was very behavior modification oriented. Put the rubber wristband around your wrist, snap it every time you're attempting to objectify a person, every time you think about masturbating, snap that, call somebody. Like, it was all about preventative measures to keep you from acting out. And you know what? That worked. It worked for me. I mean, I got sober for like 6 months and then it stopped working, because all of that, again, we call it white knuckling. So what I was doing is just suppressing all the desire for 6 months so that I could behave, because behavior management was the strategy and the goal was, I got to change my behavior without creating what is called in psychotherapy, first order change. What is first order change? When I don't want that thing anymore. And, you know, there is a real benefit to what they call harm prevention, kind of in addiction treatment in general. Like, if you're using heroin every day, it might be good to get you to just smoke pot for a while so you stop using heroin. That's a harm prevention strategy. There is some value in that approach. If I'm going out and hooking up with people, it might be better to just masturbate for a while and not be hooking up with people. But you have to go deeper than that if you're actually going to get out of the white knuckling or the pink cloud or all of the sin management, behavior management approaches, because in the long run, they require a lot of this. I've got to be vigilant. I've got to be always on the top of my game. I've got to be using the top of my brain to manage everything. And as we've talked about a lot on this podcast, Chris, those of us who struggle with legitimate sexual addiction, I'm not just talking about, oh, I watched porn for a couple of months and now I can't stop it. That might be just a porn addiction. But for those of us who are truly sexually addicted, we can't just stop it because it's rooted in complex trauma that starts way back in our early, early childhood. And you may not even have narrative memories that you can recall of the harm that's been done in your relationship with your mother and your father, which is laying the foundation for then how you go about managing your emotions, attaching to other people, finding care, comfort, connection, and having a sense of secure identity, believing in yourself. Because if there's never been anybody there for you when you cried out for help to soothe you or to make you feel alive, and you don't feel attached to people and you feel like a worthless piece of poop yourself, you're going to have a hard time leaving these behaviors that temporarily make you feel good inside.
So I'm hearing a couple things, and let's talk about both of them. And of course we'll run tangents off of that because that's what we do. We just like to chase the rabbit. But the first thing is dealing with first order issues, or I like to call it unplugging the power source behind the behavior. There is something that invited you, empowered you, was useful to you in these unwanted behaviors at some point in your life. In fact, I think you and I both talk about this, honoring the need to cope, honoring the part of yourself where the behaviors themselves actually helped you survive, right? So that's the first thing. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, This whole premises of recovery as controlling and stopping a shame-based behavior is defining that's what recovery is. I really struggled with that when I got into recovery because I was exposed to 12-step models. I was exposed to people who were talking about behavior management strategies. I went to NoFap on Reddit to check out what they were saying, to try to figure out what is it that I can do to stop this behavior, right? And I was really obsessed with that. And I got to the point where I kept failing, Scott. I was never good at long stretches of sobriety. I'm just going to tell you that. When it comes to truly managing behaviors, because I'm a deeply emotional person. And what I think is we need to focus on is it's not emotional. It's interpersonal. You were alluding to that in what you were saying. It's the attachment wounds. It's the relational harm that I received that helped push me into a false attachment with these behaviors and these sexual attraction, these sexual arousal templates that turned me on, that made me feel alive. And it was an approximation of what I wanted from the people in my life, from mom, from dad, from significant others, feeling seen and known and loved. And so the issue is not my behavior. My behavior is a symptom. My behavior is the warning light on the dashboard of my life going, hey, something's not working right here. This is behavior that stopped being beneficial to you. And I just say that because so many guys I run across are trying to get a quick fix to these issues. They're trying to stop the behavior and find a new pattern of life that will give them a sense of shamelessness. But that shamelessness doesn't come outside of attuned and vulnerable relationships.
Yeah, and that's my problem with the 12-step approach at times. I don't want to vilify the whole thing because it does work.
It's got some really beneficial, really... but The 12 steps themselves are really good. And I would argue the 12 steps are probably the best contribution to 20th century Christianity.
Yeah. But how that then gets applied, is it in a dynamic that actually reinforces my shame-based view of myself? Because I think that's the point we've got to admit, is sexual addiction comes because it's caused by shame. It's caused by interrelational shame that forms very early in our lives. I'm a bad, worthless person. There's nobody for me. There's nobody that comes when I call. There's nobody paying attention to my emotions. And my desires and my emotions are all dismissed or minimized or scolded or shamed. And so I feel like a bad person. And then I go act out in a way that makes me feel better. But I choose a way that reinforces my view of myself, which is I'm a bad, worthless person. So shame is the cause and the effect of sexual addiction. But if I'm going to change that, I can't change that with behavior. I have to go to where it started in my life, which was the interpersonal relationship with my mother and my father. And I've got to bring healing to that wounded little boy, those wounded parts of myself that learned to go seeking attachment outside of human relationship with things, with objects, with my own body, with orgasm, with pornography, whatever. And so if I get involved in a system that just focuses on that symptomology, as you call it, whether that's a CSAT, a lot of CSATs do that. They just focus on stopping the behavior. They use cognitive behavior therapy, which is all about top-down control. Just think better, think, change your thinking. And the 12 steps can get applied that way, even to the point where, well, chips are used as a, oh, I got my 12-day chip. I got my five-month chip.
Dude, let me tell you about those chips. I went to my 12-step meeting. And when I got 2 weeks, something in my brain flipped on that says, you're not worth this 2 weeks of sobriety, relapse. And then I would get 10 days, relapse, 7 days, relapse. And I had to stop going to the meetings because the key part of the meeting, and again, this is for me, this was my experience, was a check-in on sobriety dates. And I wasn't there. I wasn't relating interpersonally with anybody and being vulnerable to experience that. So that top-down management system was, it short-circuited for me really early in the process.
And it did for me too. I didn't stop going. I kept going, but I lied. Have you masturbated in the last 2 weeks? Nope. Not at all.
I can't say I haven't done that in other settings, but yes, I've done
now,
that.
Now, by masturbating, do you mean edging for 3 hours? Because right. I've done that.
Did I?
But
have
that's not orgasm? Masturbating.
See, did I? Yeah. Because masturbation in the shower doesn't count, right, Scott? I think that's the truth. Is it truth?
Yeah. Not if you don't ejaculate, okay. Chris.
I got you.
Right. We have all kinds of ways that we can get around that. And that's what happens is we either stop going or we start lying again. And so how is it really helping me change? It's not. It's just helping me go back and build that facade that I operated under for the longest time. And so that process worked for me for a while until it stopped working, until the external stress in my life got unmanageable, which is what typically happens, right? So you're going along, you're doing fine. I'm doing, oh gosh, I haven't masturbated in 6 months. And then boom, something happens that emotionally sets me off. And I can't deal with the overwhelming emotions. And I go back to what I've always done when I feel emotionally dysregulated, when I feel angry, afraid, sad, or extreme shame. I go back to soothing myself or escaping from the pain of my current hellhole into a fantasy world of my own that temporarily makes me feel good, but it also reinforces my view that I'm a piece of shit. So it didn't work for me.
Yeah. And I want to reinforce that from our friend Jay Stringer. When we talk about behavior management, one of the things he brings out in his book Unwanted is that I don't go back to the behavior because I want the dopamine hit, because I want to get high. I go back to the behavior because I believe I deserve to feel like a piece of shit.
And there's a reason we self-sabotage.
Yes. Yes, because it's an identity piece. It's what has been soaked into my body in the absence of attuned relationships. And when I say attuned, people seeing me and asking, you okay? You doing all right? I mean, we got on the call today and first thing you said to me, how you doing? You doing all right? Because, you know, I'm in a bit of a funk right now. And so,
and I heard it in the tone of your voice.
Right. But it's that attunement right there that makes me feel cared and loved for, that makes me go, I don't need this stuff. I don't need to go back to the old haunts. Because I've got friends, I've got people that care for me, I've got people that can be with me in a way that I didn't have growing up or developing as a young man. And so when we're in this space, Scott, what is it that I think is so attractive? What is it that you think is so attractive to people who want to just talk about the behavior and deal with the stopping the behavior and not dealing with the underlying issues?
Well, I feel like it falls into kind of a, I would say, a mega, kind of a meta narrative that we have to be in charge of our lives. We have to have a sense of agency, right? So I have to feel like that the actions that I take can actually make a difference in my life. And there is truth in that. Like if you don't feel like you have any sense of agency whatsoever, if you have this kind of learned helplessness, which a lot of us with childhood trauma do have, we feel like no matter what we do, it doesn't matter. I'm always going to end up back here acting out again. What's the use? I might as well just give up and indulge. So that false belief has to be confronted, and you do have to restore people to a sense of, hey, I can actually do things that impact and make a difference in my life to a degree. But I'm not God. I don't control all the circumstances of the world. I don't even control all the circumstances of my life. So all I can do is the best I can do. All I can do is point myself in the direction that I want to go. And I don't really control all the circumstances. I don't control how my wife is going to respond. I don't control how my children or my boss or all the other, you know, I don't control what I'm going to be triggered by walking down the street. Do you? I mean, I can control my triggers to a point. I don't have to go on HBO and watch, you know, gay themed shows if that's triggering to me, but I can't help but walk down the street and notice a billboard of a scantily clad woman or man. I'm not going to be able to control that.
Well, and so that therein lies this idea of that you can actually eliminate temptation, eliminate the struggle, is that there's this lie that's been told in white knuckling or pink cloud recovery, that if you just get enough rigidity, if you just get enough discipline, if you just have enough mental awareness to, I think in scripture, it talks about, you know, to turn and run, you know, flee temptation, right? And so it's this idea that, well, I need to be fleeing all the temptations in my life. But what you're saying is so true. I go to the grocery store. I see people that may be attractive. They're just shopping for groceries. And here I am in an emotionally vulnerable state. And I've learned over the course of my life to objectify people. And we'll talk about that in another episode. But when we struggle as men or women for that matter with consuming other people, it's not because we have a lust problem. It's because we're looking for connection and we don't know how to get it. And lust is kind of like this idea that's been kind of been around as just, well, I can stop that. You can't stop wanting. Wanting is good. It's finding what do I really want beneath the consumption of billboards and people outside or on the internet or on social media that I see, and I just go, something like clicks inside of me and goes, oh, damn, I want that.
And that's why Jay's approach in Unwanted was so revolutionary for me when I first found the book, because he was saying, you know, your sexual fantasies, your porn usage habits, the things that turn you on, they're actually pathways to wisdom, to understanding what you're really looking for if you'll be curious about it. But no, most of us are not curious about it. We've been taught to stamp that out of existence. So the way we're taught to flee from temptation is not to be introspective about it and to be inquisitive about it. We're taught to run from it, like it's going to chase us down and gobble us up if we don't, you know, immediately resist that. And unfortunately, what that does is it makes the temptation more intense. Relying on this.
Let's talk about that, because when we shut down the desire, where does it take us? I mean, it takes us back to that place of shame again, where the struggle began.
Your problem is you want too much, Chris. Yeah. You are too needy.
Yeah.
Think about the word needy. when I say it, what happens in your body? What is your relationship just to that word?
I feel like I'm not enough. I feel like there's something wrong with me. I need to work on something to be less needy. And so it takes me into that very emotionally disintegrated. And that's one of the pieces that I wanted to bring to this conversation is I was blessed sitting with a therapist who is not a cognitive behavioral guy per se. He's more of a story guy. And I asked him this question. I said, listen, I'm struggling with these two words. How can I reconcile the process of recovery with this idea of sobriety? And this is a guy that's been doing work for two or three decades. And he goes, Chris, all I can tell you is both of those words are kind of loaded for me. What I'm really looking for in the process of getting healthy is this word integration, bringing everything into one place. And that's exactly what you're talking about. When I'm having a desire or a need and I run to something that is shameful in my mind to satisfy it, rather than shutting it down and trying to mute it, I open it up and get curious about it and say, okay, what am I really looking for? And I invite people into my life as I talk about this in group settings and with safe conversations, invite people in my life to say, this is what I'm feeling right now. This is what I'm thinking about. This is what I'm wanting right now. Well, I don't know what the hell to do with this. And that process of bringing everything together and being kind toward all of it, toward my childhood, toward my adult struggles, toward the consequences of the things that have come up because of my brokenness and my addictions, all those things need curiosity and kindness, which is why we use those words so much in this conversation.
Yeah. So I just want to just point out what we've been talking about for the last 10 minutes is so complex. It doesn't fit into that neat categorical, like sin management, behavior management approach, because now we're talking about fragmentation, which happens in trauma. We're talking about isolation, which also happens in trauma. We're talking about our tendency to dissociate, to disconnect from our bodies and our feelings. We're talking about our relationship to God and how he creates us in a state of need and our shame about our neediness. And all of these complex factors are being held together in this same conversation that we're having. That doesn't go in nice little boxes like, well, just snap the rubber band, or just don't do that, or just don't go there, or don't look at that. Because you're never going to get away from how you were created by God to function.
Because all those things are interpersonal. They're all interpersonal.
And you are needy.
Yeah.
You were created. Here's the garden narrative, if you want to look at it this way. God creates Adam and he goes, oh, it's not good for him to be alone. God, in his humility, creates a being like us that needs other beings like us, not just God.
And I would put another synonym on the word needy. We're dependent. And we don't like that idea. We like to be, especially as Westerners, independent. Right.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And so it's just me and Jesus, or me and God, we got it. No, you don't.
No,
no, you don't.
Hell no. In fact, if you say it's just you and God have it, you're ignoring a large part of God's revelation, which says it's you and God and others. If you don't have the others, you don't have you and God.
So back to, you asked me this question, why is this so appealing to us? Because it gives us the illusion of power. And boy, we want to be powerful more than anything else because we feel so weak and needy at times. And when I'm walking down the street and I see that image of another person that is so beautiful, and it reminds me of all the ways I'm not beautiful, and I'm drawn to that, it is not only pulling me into eroticism, it's also pulling me into my neediness, into my pathetic sense of not being enough. And that's really what's got to be engaged if I'm ever going to stop desiring what I see there as an ideal of masculinity or the ideal female. You know, I gotta, I have a guy that I've been working with a long time, and his fantasy is to have sex with the perfect woman. So he spends a lot of time searching for the perfect woman. And then once he finds her, boom, it's masturbate. But it takes him time to find the perfect woman. And part of his arousal structure is about the search for the perfect woman. And I've been missing a piece of this for a year. And we just hit on it last week. And I said, why do you have to have sex with the perfect woman? He goes, I don't know. I said, doesn't it make you the perfect man?
Ooh.
Oh.
Wow.
That puzzle piece just clicked. You could feel the click in the room.
It was like, and it was like searching for that jigsaw puzzle piece that you've been looking for hours. And you find it and you plop it in. It has that noise. And you're oh, it's almost a deep guttural sigh, peace, pleasure, all in one.
Oh, he visibly sighed when I said that. Yeah. So there was a reaction in his body, and I felt it in my body too. And I was like, oh, but notice this, that took over a year of working constantly week by week in group and individually to establish safety in the relationship, for him to reveal a lot of details about his arousal template and how he acts out and his story and when that started in his life and all of that, to actually come to this insight that it's not about the perfect woman. It's about the perfect woman makes you the perfect man. And there's the rub. None of us feel like the perfect man, do we?
No. And what's funny about, not funny, what is ironic about that analogy is there is no such thing as the perfect woman. It just feels that way in my arousal. When I get excited, I mean, you know, it's like what they call it, like beer goggles, right? You have four or five beers and everybody's a 10. So in my desperation, I find this person who fits my arousal template. She checks all the boxes, or he checks all the boxes that make me come alive. And I see them and I'm drawn to them and I want to fit with them. And yet there is no click. There's no true integration in acting out in that way with that person, because it's a substitute for, and I'm just going to say this, for loving myself. I cannot and will not recover or stop my shameful behaviors or build healthy relationships or even find God if I cannot accept all the parts of me, those things that are very good. I mean, dude, it's so challenging for me to sit with how I am gifted, because I want to be like, somebody pays me a compliment, I'm like, oh, well, thank you so much. That yeah, whatever. I want to poo-poo that. But the reality is I have a hard time accepting that and loving that, as well as the things that I've screwed up and really, you know, are ashamed of and still to this day struggle in. That's the interpersonal garden from which I'm trying to grow.
Yeah. So I love that metaphor that you just said, the garden, because we were created, again, back to the creation narrative, we're created to live in this garden named Eden. The word means delight. We're created to live in a place of delight and shalom. And shalom is simply the biblical word for integration, what you're talking about. We're whole. We're able to hold in tension this reality that there is goodness and there is shadow in me, right? And instead of this very binary way of looking at the world as there's good Scott and there's bad Scott, and that's one of the things that happens in trauma, is that fragmentation breaks me apart into these different parts of myself that I have to hide. I have to hide bad Scott, except when he's on the prowl. Then I can let him out. He goes and acts like a werewolf and satisfies his appetite. And then back he goes into the cage.
And then the moon goes down and there's no more werewolf. And I can feel like good Scott again, or good Chris again.
Yeah. And so I live in this very bifurcated existence. It's maddening. Whereas when I can accept there is darkness, there is shadow in me, I have depravity in me, but there's also glory and goodness in me. And I have to hold those two things in tension.
Yes.
I think they call that maturity, Chris.
What? What is that, Scott? I don't know. That's not what I'm not looking for maturity. I'm looking for perfection. I don't know about you, but my goal is to be perfect in this life. I've got to put all the dirty things away. I can only present myself as the nice, shiny, neat, beautiful Chris. That's what I'm trying to get to. I don't know what this maturity shit you're talking about is.
And that would be really funny if people didn't really think that way. And you and I both know that we all think that way. Yeah. That there's this secret longing in us to be perfect, to be that person that has it all together so that we can get all the bragging right,
Scott, do you know what the word in scripture for perfect means? Maturity.
Isn't it mature? Yeah. I'm able to hold intention.
Hey, for all you theologians out there, send us a message on YouTube or your favorite podcast platform, or you can email us at wegotballs00@gmail.com. There is no such thing as moral perfection in the Bible. Let's talk about that. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, it's not going to happen in this life. There's this sense in which we're created in this garden of delight to live in shalom, and it's shattered, and we know it's shattered, and we're trying to get back there. And we have all these techniques and all these methodologies and all these things to get back. And what if that's impossible? What if we have to just live with the brokenness of the world that we find, which is in us as well, but hold intention the reality that there's great beauty and there's great brokenness at the same time existing in me, in you, in the world. And that's what we're called to live with. That's what we're called into growing in maturity in that process. And that's why all of these techniques that eliminate that basically try to get you to believe that you can live a perfect life now, bro, this is not your best life now.
It's snake oil, buddy. It's snake oil. You're getting sold a bill of goods. And the reality is there's a lot of work to do. And part of the unplugging of that traumatic dynamic that we've been talking about for Scott and I both has been going back and doing work and doing more work in my story, in my family of origin, with my traumas. And Scott, I'll even say this. I did some work this past summer on an adult trauma, something that I perpetrated that I had to sit with a group of guys to be able to feel the grief of what I had done. Not only what was done to me, there's grief and anger and longing there, but there's grief in what I've done as an adult. So it's all kind of things. But if you think you can heal by changing your behaviors, my friend, I'm sorry. Somebody has lied to you. We're here to tell you the truth. We want to invite you with curiosity and kindness into doing the work of what happened to you to make you want these behaviors to soothe yourself in the first place. Where did that story begin?
Yeah. Gosh, that sounds like maturity, Chris, what you did. Because I've had to do the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not just that I've been hurt. It's that I've hurt others out of my hurt.
Yeah.
And that's how trauma gets passed down one generation to the next.
Yeah.
But our ability to actually engage how we've been harmed has given us a greater ability to be honest about how we've also harmed. Because if I can't do that work of how I was set up for this, I can't have compassion on myself. And if I can't have compassion on myself, I'm certainly not going to be empathetic to how I've harmed others.
And guess what, Scott? I'm still harming myself. Yeah. I'm still harming the ones that I love. There's not a place that I come to where I stop the harm.
But you repair.
That's exactly my point. I have learned that the process is not getting it right. The process is acknowledging the harm and working to repair. And that's, hey, guess what? Read your Bibles. That's the story of redemption.
That might be called repentance.
So at any point in time, God could speak words and wash all the brokenness off the face of the earth. And why has he not chosen to do that? My argument is because the story of rupture and repair is his story. And without the harm, without the brokenness, there's no rupture to be repaired. We can't feel interpersonally the love and forgiveness and kindness and reconnection that is so much stronger than the original bonds ever were.
I am totally convinced that that is the message of the entire gospel, is it's about rupture and repair. And here's why. If you can't say no to somebody, your yes is meaningless. Yeah. If you can't refuse God's love, then you can't actually love God freely from your heart. And so God allows the universe to emerge with this property of fallenness, yep, to break, so that he can come and demonstrate his love to us, because he doesn't owe us anything. And yet his demonstration of love is, you have ruptured the relationship, but I'm pursuing you.
So go back to the word Eden. He gets to demonstrate his desire and invite us to desire with him. See where that goes, guys.
That's a beautiful thing.
See where that goes. What if your problem was not your behavior, but the struggle with your desire, of being honest and kind to what you really wanted, what's really going on underneath it all? So what we want is for you guys to continue to grow and heal. So we want to invite you to do the work. Reach out to us if we can help you engage some of those stories. They're out there. You may be thinking about doing it. You may have done some story work. We want to invite you to do story work in an attuned and connected environment where you can be safe and known and challenged by other men who are walking with you. So keep listening to the podcast. Reach out to us if we can help. And we'll see you soon on another episode of We Got Balls.
And you do too.
Take care, guys.
Don't forget to subscribe for more episodes. You can connect with Chris and with Scott at SuccessfulMen.com.